Dairy. Let cultured dairy products be the secret weapon in your quest for acid balance. Change a salad by topping it with cheese, be it Greek feta, Italian gorgonzola, or Spanish manchego. Spoon sour cream over latkes, Mexican crema over tacos, creme fraiche onto a French berry tart, and yogurt over the little lamb kebabs most of Eastern Asia calls koufta. Look at a lamb shoulder and know you can take it to Morocco by braising it with preserved lemons, to the south of France with some white wine and picholine olives, or to Greece with red wine and tomatoes. The same cabbage slaw can evoke the American South when made with mustard and cider vinegar, Mexico when made with lime juice and cilantro, or the Chinese kitchen when spiked with rice vinegar, scallions, and toasted peanuts. Learn to not only consider, but also take advantage of the flavor of an acid to guide the direction a dish takes. How acid works. Though acid primarily affects flavor, it can also trigger chemical reactions that change the color and texture of food. Learn to anticipate these effects so you can make better decisions about how and when to add acid. Acid and color. Acid dulls vibrant greens, so wait until the last possible moment to dress salads, mix vinegar into herb salsas, and squeeze lemon over cooked green vegetables such as spinach. On the other hand, acid keeps reds and purples vivid. Cabbage, red chard stems, or beets will best retain their color when cooked with anything slightly acidic, such as apples, lemon, or vinegar. Raw fruits and vegetables that are susceptible to oxidation, the enzymatic browning that results from exposure to oxygen, sliced apples, artichokes, bananas, and avocados, will retain their natural color if coated with a little acid or kept in water mixed with a few drops of lemon juice or vinegar until they are ready to cook or eat. Acid and texture. Acid keeps vegetables and legumes tougher longer. Anything containing cellulose or pectin, including legumes, fruits, and vegetables, will cook much more slowly in the presence of acid. While 10 to 15 minutes of simmering in water is enough to soften carrots into baby food, they'll still be somewhat firm after an hour of stewing in red wine. The acid in tomatoes explains why those pesky onions float to the top of a pot of sauce or soup and stay there, never getting soft, even after hours of cooking. To prevent this crunchy mishap, cook onions until they're tender before adding any tomatoes, wine, or vinegar to the pot. When cooking beans or any legumes, including the chickpeas for hummus, a pinch of baking soda will gently nudge the bean water away from acidity toward alkalinity, ensuring tenderness. And just like those onions, cook legumes until they are completely tender before adding anything acidic. A great Mexican chef once told me that dousing cooked beans with vinegar or vinaigrette sort of uncooks them, tightening and toughening the skins a bit. Account for that tightening when preparing beans for a salad, and cook the beans just a touch longer than you might otherwise. Use this chemistry to your advantage when deciding how to cook vegetables. Boiling dilutes the relatively acidic liquid contained in vegetable cells, so it will generally yield more tender vegetables than roasting will. Roast big, beautiful slices of cauliflower or Romanesco broccoli to ensure they retain their shape. Boil potatoes or parsnips so that they melt into a puddle of tenderness, perfect for pureeing or mashing. Acid also encourages bonds between pectin groups, the gelling agent in fruit, so that they can trap water to help set jam or jelly. Some fruits, such as apples and blueberries, don't contain enough acid to bond the pectin on their own, so we help them along by squeezing some fresh lemon juice into the jam pot and into fruit fillings for pies and cobblers to encourage them to set. Acid is required when using chemical leavenings such as baking soda or baking powder. Visualize the baking soda and vinegar volcanoes of your elementary school science projects. Just like that, but on a much smaller scale, acid reacts with baking soda to release carbon dioxide bubbles to leaven baked goods. Doughs and batters leavened by baking soda should also have an acidic ingredient, such as natural cocoa powder, brown sugar, honey, or buttermilk. Baking powder, on the other hand, already contains powdered tartaric acid and doesn't need an external source of acid to react. Acid encourages the proteins in an egg white to assemble, or coagulate, more quickly but less densely than they otherwise would. Under normal conditions, strands of egg proteins unravel and tighten when heated. As they do, the strands squeeze out water, causing eggs to toughen and dry out. Acid draws egg proteins together before they can unravel, which inhibits them from joining too closely. A few secret drops of lemon juice will produce creamier, more tender scrambled eggs. For perfect poached eggs, add a capful of vinegar into boiling water to help speed up coagulation of the white and strengthen the outer texture while preserving the runny yolk. Acid aids in stabilizing whipped egg whites by encouraging more, finer air pockets, helping to increase the volume of the egg white foam. Though cream of tartar, a byproduct of winemaking, is the form of acid traditionally added to egg whites as they're whipped for meringues, cakes, and soufflés, a few drops of vinegar or lemon juice per egg white will yield a similar result. Dairy proteins called casein will coagulate or curdle with the addition of acid. With the exception of butter and heavy cream, which are very low in protein, dairy should only be added to acidic dishes at the last minute. While curdled fresh dairy, when unintended, is usually inedible, the same reaction makes cultured dairy, from yogurt to creme fraiche to cheese, possible, offering us a delicious, entirely new category of acidic ingredients to incorporate into food. Try making your own creme fraiche. It couldn't be easier. Just combine 2 tablespoons of creme fraiche or cultured buttermilk with 2 cups of heavy cream. Pour into a clean glass jar, cover loosely or leave uncovered, and leave out at warm room temperature for 2 days or until it thickens. That's it. Use it in blue cheese dressing, chicken with vinegar, or tangy whipped cream. Cover and store it in the fridge for up to 2 weeks. Use the last few spoonfuls to start the next batch in the same way. When acid is incorporated into doughs and batters, it will tenderize them, much as fat does. Whether it comes in the form of cultured dairy, natural, non-alkalized cocoa powder, or vinegar, acid in a dough or batter will disrupt the gluten network, resulting in a more tender product. If it's chewiness you're after, wait as long as possible into the process of dough making to add acidic ingredients. Acid tenderizes, then toughens, meat and fish proteins. Imagine protein as coiled strands folded up into bundles. When acid comes into contact with the coils, they unfold and unwind. This process is called denaturation. These denatured proteins then begin to bump into each other and coagulate, reconnecting into an intimate network. The same thing happens when proteins are heated, which is why acid is sometimes said to cook meat or fish. At first, the intimate network traps water that was previously bound up in muscle fibers, leading to moist, tender food. But if the denaturation conditions persist, that is, if food continues to sit in acid, the protein network will continue to tighten, squeezing water out of the protein altogether, resulting in tough, dry food, much like an overcooked steak. To understand this progression, consider the way the texture of a piece of sashimi will become tender, bright-tasting fish tartare with the addition of acid, and then turn into a chewy ceviche over time. Fish meant for cooking shouldn't marinate in acid for more than a few minutes, but dip any flaky, white-fleshed fish into buttermilk and flour before frying, or toss sea bass with lemon juice and curry powder just before skewering and grilling, and you'll get the benefit of moist texture along with the pleasant hit of tartness. Acid also helps break down collagen, the main structural protein found in tough cuts of meat. Add wine or tomatoes as you begin to cook braises and stews, since the more quickly the collagen melts, the sooner the meat will grow juicy and succulent. Producing acid. While we introduce salt and fat into our food in the form of distinct ingredients, there are 2 easy ways to produce acid in food as we cook. One process is rather fast, the other rather slow. The fast method? Browning foods. In the salt and fat chapters, I explained that food begins to brown once its surface temperature climbs considerably beyond the boiling point. This can happen in the toaster to a slice of bread, in the oven to cookies and cake, on the grill to meats, fish, and vegetables, or in the pan to caramel. The chemical reaction involved in browning sugars is called caramelization. The chemical reaction involved in browning meats, seafood, vegetables, baked goods, or just about anything else is called the Maillard reaction, after Louis-Camille Maillard, the scientist who discovered it. There will be more details about these delicious, mysterious chemical reactions in the heat chapter. Though they're entirely different processes, caramelization and the Maillard reactions share some similarities. Both create acidic flavor compounds in addition to many other tasty molecules as byproducts. As it caramelizes, a single sugar molecule will develop into hundreds of new and different compounds, including some acids. In other words, equal amounts of sugar and burnt caramel by weight are not equally sweet. And in fact, caramel is acidic. Similar acidic compounds are produced in carbohydrates and proteins by the Maillard reaction. Though producing acidity is rarely a reason to brown food, knowing that the process will develop a host of new flavors, including some sour ones, can be a valuable tool. Imagine tasting two batches of ice cream, both made with the same amount of sugar. In one batch, the sugar was added directly to the dairy. In the other batch, some of the sugar was cooked into dark caramel before being mixed in. The ice cream made with caramelized sugar will not only taste less sweet, but will also be far more complex because it has the vital flavor contrasts that acid provides. The other, much slower method for producing acid in the kitchen is fermentation, where, in addition to many other flavor-producing processes, carbohydrates transform into carbon dioxide and acids or alcohols using yeasts, bacteria, or a combination thereof. Wine, beer, and cider are, of course, fermented, but so are naturally leavened breads, all sorts of pickles, cured meats, cultured dairy, and even coffee and chocolate. Some of the most delicious bread I've tasted is naturally leavened and has been allowed to rise, which is to say ferment, slowly. According to Chad Robertson of Tartine Bakery in San Francisco, who lets his dough rise for more than 30 hours, slow fermentation improves the flavor, in large part because more sugars are available to caramelize during the baking. The loaves brown faster and the crust gets darker. Subtly sour, Chad's bread is layered with complex flavors. Every time I taste it, I enthusiastically declare it the best loaf of bread in the world. Bake a naturally leavened loaf of bread sometime when your schedule allows. The results can be stellar, especially if you bake it Chad's way and let the elements in the crust undergo both caramelization and the Maillard reaction, yielding layer upon layer of acidity and sweetness. Using acid. As with all good cooking, the best way to use acid well is to taste over and over again. Using acid is much like using salt. If something is noticeably sour, it's probably got too much acid. But if a food tastes bright and clean, then its acid balance is spot on. Layering acid. When considering acid, think about which acid or combination of acids to use and when to add them. Just as with salt and fat, a single dish can often benefit from several forms of acid. Think of this as layering acids as you cook. Cooking acids. Learn to use acid like salt to season food from within. While acid presents many last-second opportunities to adjust dishes with a final squeeze of lemon, crumble of goat cheese, or pile of pickles, some acids should be worked into dishes from the start. These are what I call cooking acids. Examples include tomatoes in pasta sauce, white wine in poultry ragu, beer in a pot of chili, vinegar in chicken with vinegar, and mirin, rice wine, in glazed five-spice chicken. Cooking acids tend to be mellow, transforming the foods with which they are cooked slowly over time. They can be extraordinarily subtle. While their presence may go undetected, their absence is sharply felt. I learned this painful lesson when, at the request of a distant relative, I tried to make beef bourguignon without the bourgogne in Iran, where wine isn't readily available. No matter what I did, I couldn't get the dish to taste right without that crucial ingredient. Give acid the time it needs to do its silent work when macerating shallots and onions. Macerate, from Latin to soften, refers to the process whereby ingredients soak in some form of acid, usually vinegar or citrus juice, to soften their harshness. Simply coat the shallots or onions in acid. They don't need to be completely submerged. If you plan on using a couple of tablespoons of vinegar for a dressing, just coat the shallots with it first, and wait 15 or 20 minutes before adding oil to build the dressing in the same cup or bowl. It will be enough to prevent dragon breath. There's no replacement for working acid early into braises and stews. The remarkable alchemy of thyme and heat will soften any dish's sharp edges. Omit the tomatoes and beer from pork braised with chilies, and the sweetness of the aromatic base of onions and garlic will dominate. The sweetness resulting from browning needs the foil of acid too. Deglazing a pan with wine, whether for risotto, pork chops, fish fillets, or a more complex reduction sauce, will keep a dish from skewing too sweet. Garnishing acids. Garnishing acids, on the other hand, are used to finish a dish. While no amount of salt at the table will make up for under-seasoning food from within, a hit of acid at the very last second often improves food, which is why garnishing acids are so important. As the volatile aromatic molecules disperse over time, the flavor of fresh citrus juice will transform, losing some of its brightness, so freshly squeezed juice is best. The application of heat will change the flavors of both citrus juice and vinegar, dulling the former and mellowing the latter, so add them just before serving when you want their full flavor impact. You can incorporate different garnishing acids into a single dish to increase flavor. Balsamic vinegar isn't always acidic enough to dress a salad on its own, so spike it with red wine vinegar. Or layer vinegar with citrus juice, which is brighter. Make citrus vinaigrette with white wine vinegar and blood orange juice to drizzle over an avocado salad. The strong acidity of the vinegar will balance the richness of the avocado, while the vivid orange juice will round out its flavor. When you can, use the same kind of acid for cooking and garnishing. Spoon tomato salsa, for example, atop pork braised with tomatoes. Finish a risotto with a fresh splash of wine from the same bottle used earlier to deglaze the pan. This kind of layering offers multiple tastes of the same ingredient. And then there are times when a single form of acid isn't enough to accomplish its task. Feta cheese, tomato, olives, and red wine vinegar offer four distinct forms of acid in a Greek salad. To bring out a chorus of bright, happy notes, serve that pork I mentioned above with all kinds of acidic condiments, including queso fresco, sour cream, and a bright cabbage slaw tossed with vinegar and lime juice. And think back to that Caesar salad where Parmesan and Worcestershire sauce, sources of acid, both lend the dressing tang as well as salt and umami. Balance the creamy, salty dressing with wine vinegar and lemon juice. Tinker with all four sources of acid as you taste and adjust, little by little, until it's perfect. Make pasta alla vongole to practice layering acids. I like to make clam pasta with two varieties of clams. Little necks, which lend an intense brininess to the dish, and manillas, which are small enough to toss in whole and eat directly out of the shell along with the pasta. First, set a pot of water to boil and season it with salt. Rinse the clams and dice an onion, saving the root ends. Heat a large frying pan over medium heat and splash in some olive oil. Add the root ends of the onion, a few parsley sprigs, and as many little necks as will fit in a single layer. Then pour in enough wine to cover the bottom of the pan. Turn the heat up and cover the pan. Let the clams steam until they open, which should take 2 or 3 minutes. Use tongs to pull the clams from the pan into a bowl as they open. Some of the stragglers might need a little encouragement, so tap them with your tongs if they're taking too long. Cook the rest of the little necks in this way, adding more wine if needed to cover the bottom of the pan. When you've removed all of the clams from the pan, strain the liquid through a fine mesh strainer or cheesecloth. This clam cooking liquid is priceless. Plus, it's now the dish's main source of acid. When the clams are cool enough to handle, pluck them from their shells and run a knife through them, then return them to the clam cooking liquid. Rinse out the frying pan, then set it over medium heat. Add just enough oil to coat the pan, and when it shimmers, add the diced onion and a pinch of salt. Stirring from time to time, cook the onion until it's tender. It's fine if it picks up a little color, but don't let it burn. Add a splash of water if you need to. Then taste the pasta water. Make sure it's as salty as the sea, and cook the linguine until it's not quite al dente, about 6 or 7 minutes. Add a clove or two of sliced garlic and some red pepper flakes to the onion, and allow it to bloom, or sizzle gently without taking on any color. Then add the manillas and crank up the heat to high. Add a healthy splash of the clam cooking liquid and cover the pan. As soon as the little clams pop open, use a slotted spoon to add the chopped little necks into the pan. Cook all of the clams together for about a minute, and then taste and adjust the acid with more white wine or a squeeze of fresh lemon juice. When the pasta is not yet al dente, drain it, reserving a cup of the pasta water. Add the noodles directly to the pan with the clams. Continue to cook the pasta, swirling the pan until the noodles are cooked al dente. This way, the pasta will absorb all the briny flavor of the clam liquid as it finishes cooking. Taste again and adjust for salt, acid, and spiciness. If the noodles seem dry, add some of the reserved pasta water. Now begins the magic of garnishing and fat. Intensify the creaminess and flavor of the dish by tossing in a knob of butter. Next, add chopped parsley and some freshly grated Parmesan. Some might balk at adding cheese to a seafood pasta, but I learned this trick from the chef at a beloved seafood restaurant in Tuscany, where this pasta was so delicious it helped me overcome my lifelong aversion to clams. The salt, fat, acid, and umami offered by the cheese makes this pasta unforgettable. For a final touch of acid and crunch, sprinkle the dish with toasted sourdough breadcrumbs. They'll be crisp when you first dig in, but as they mingle with the pasta, the breadcrumbs will absorb the clam juice, becoming little flavor bombs exploding with each bite. Condiments and umami. Cervantes may have thought that hunger is the best sauce, but I'd argue that sauce is the best sauce, because sauce can complete a dish. Sauce, and in fact most condiments, are sources of both acid and salt, and they offer a pretty surefire way to improve flavor. The bonus is that they are often excellent sources of umami, which is the word from Japanese for the fifth taste we can sense, the other four being sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. The closest translation into English is something like deliciousness or savoriness. Umami is, in fact, the result of flavor compounds called glutamates. The most familiar glutamate is monosodium glutamate, or MSG, the white powder often generously used in the kitchens of Chinese restaurants to enhance flavor. Though MSG is chemically manufactured, there are also many natural sources of glutamates. Two foods most abundant in naturally occurring glutamates are Parmesan and tomato ketchup. Sometimes a grating of Parmesan can make the difference between a good bowl of pasta and a great one, even pasta alle vongole. And then there are those of us who always crave ketchup with our burgers and fries, and not only because of the sweetness, salt, and acid it provides. A little ketchup and the umami it offers makes things taste inexplicably more delicious. Since the list of foods rich in umami dovetails nicely with many sources of salt and acid, always seek the opportunity to work in a little umami along with salt or acid to heighten flavor without having to do any extra work. However, as Cal Peternell, the chef who'd shocked me with his palmfuls of salt in that pot of polenta so many years ago, likes to say, there is such a thing as two-mami, so don't be tempted to pack bacon and tomatoes and fish sauce and cheese and mushrooms into a single meal. A little bit of umami can go a long way. Balancing sweetness with acid. Imagine taking a bite of the perfect peach. It's sweet, juicy, and firm, yet giving. But is that all? It's also acidic. Without that pucker, it'd be all sugar. Pastry chefs know that the best thing we can do in our cooking is to mimic this perfection. There's no better model for getting that sweet-sour balance just right than nature itself. The best apples for pie aren't the sweetest, but tart varieties, such as Fuji, Honeycrisp, and Sierra Beauty. If a dessert's only quality is sweetness, it stimulates only the taste buds that sense sweetness. Chocolate and coffee are the perfect basis for building desserts because they are bitter, sour, and rich in umami. Once sweetened, they trigger more types of taste buds. Caramel, too. Add salt, and suddenly all five of our basic tastes are activated with a single bite. For this reason, salted caramel sauce has never gone out of fashion, and it never will. Always balance sweetness with acid, and not only in desserts. Roasted beets full of sugar benefit from a splash of red wine vinegar, which offers contrast to the naturally earthy flavor of the beets that is so off-putting to some. Season them with olive oil and salt, and all of a sudden, even the staunchest beet phobe will be converted. roasted carrots, cauliflower, and broccoli, or anything that's developed sweetness from browning, will always appreciate a squeeze of lemon or touch of vinegar. A little will go a long way. Acid balance in a meal. From time to time, I travel with Alice Waters to help cook special dinners. During one particularly rich wintry meal we served in Washington, D.C., while the snow piled up outside, I had an epiphany about acid. The last savory course was a garden lettuce salad dressed with delicate vinaigrette, which we sent out in big bowls to be eaten family style. After we served the salad, all the cooks stood in the kitchen, exhausted, absent-mindedly shoving lettuce into our mouths with our fingers. After a long day of cooking in a dry, hot, crowded kitchen, none of us had ever tasted anything so delicious. We were all marveling about how refreshing and perfectly dressed the salad was when Alice walked into the kitchen and said it could have used some more acid. We were confounded. We were downright besotted with the salad, and yet here she was telling us the balance was off? We all protested, trying to get Alice to admit she was wrong. But Alice was steadfast. She pointed out that we hadn't been at the table with her, piling salad onto a plate laden with grilled lamb and shelling beans, garnished with a decadent sauce, following courses of creamy lasagna and rich shellfish soup. On a plate with all of that other stuff, it wasn't doing its job. A salad should relieve your palate and leave it clean after rich, muddy foods. It needed more acid to stand up to the other intense flavors. Alice was right. That happens a lot. In order to make the best salad, you have to consider how it fits into the meal. Though each dish on its own should always be balanced in salt, fat, and acid, there is also the larger picture to consider. A good meal should also be balanced. Make a caramelized onion tart with all that butter in the crust and onions, and serve it with garden lettuces dressed with a sharp mustard vinaigrette. Make long-cooked pork shoulder, southern barbecue style, and pair it with a bright acidic slaw. Make a rich Thai curry thick with coconut milk, but precede it with a crunchy, light shaved cucumber salad. Begin to incorporate this sort of balance with every meal you plan. Then listen on to What to Cook for more tips on writing a balanced menu. Improvising with salt, fat, and acid. Think of any dish you absolutely love to eat. It probably has an ideal balance of salt, fat, and acid, whether it's a bowl of tortilla soup, Caesar salad, a banh mi sandwich, a margarita pizza, or a bite of feta cheese tucked with cucumber into a piece of lavash bread. Since the human body can't produce certain essential forms of salt, fat, and acid, our palates have evolved to seek these three elements. This results in a universal appeal to food with salt, fat, and acid all in balance, no matter the cuisine. On their own, salt, fat, and acid can give shape to the idea for a dish or even a meal. When deciding upon what to make, first answer the questions of which form or forms of each element to use, of how and when. You'll find yourself with a to-do list that resembles, wait for it, a kind of recipe. If you want to turn last night's leftover roast chicken into chicken salad sandwiches, for instance, think first about whether you're craving Indian, Sicilian, or classic American flavors. Once you decide, refer to the world of acid in the accompanying PDF to help you choose the forms of salt, fat, and acid that will take you in the right direction. To evoke a taste of India, you might use thick, full-fat yogurt, cilantro, onions macerated in lime juice, salt, and a hint of curry powder. To conjure up a night on the shores of Palermo, you could use lemon juice and zest, onions macerated in red wine vinegar, aioli, fennel seeds, and sea salt. Or try a chicken salad sandwich inspired by Cobb salad, with huge crumbles of bacon and blue cheese and slices of hard-cooked egg and avocado. Then dress everything with a red wine vinaigrette before loading it onto the bread. If the thought of improvisational cooking scares you, take it slowly. Grow comfortable with a basic repertoire of dishes, and then start to play with one component at a time. Make bright cabbage slaw enough times to memorize its ingredients and method, then adapt it as you like by varying the fat, acid, or both. Use mayonnaise instead of olive oil to make a classic southern variation, and rice wine vinegar instead of red wine vinegar to make an Asian one. Play to each element's strengths. Use salt to enhance, fat to carry, and acid to balance flavor. Now, with the knowledge of how they affect various foods, add each to a dish at the right time in order to season it from within. Add salt early to a pot of beans, but acid late. Season meat for a braise in advance, then start it off on the heat with a dose of cooking acid. When it's done and rich in flavor, lighten it with a garnishing acid. Let salt, fat, and acid work together in concert to improve anything you eat, whether you cooked it or not. Doctor a lackluster restaurant taco by asking for sour cream, guacamole, pickles, or salsa. Eye the dressings, cheeses, and pickles at the local salad bar with renewed interest. Use yogurt, tahini, pepper sauce, and pickled onions to amend a dry, bland falafel sandwich. Harmonize these three notes, and invariably, your taste buds will sing with delight. Heat. When aspiring chefs ask me for career advice, I offer a few tips. Cook every single day. Taste everything thoughtfully. Go to the farmer's market and familiarize yourself with each season's produce. Read everything Paula Wolfert, James Beard, Marcella Hazan, and Jane Grigson have written about food. Write a letter to your favorite restaurant professing your love and beg for an apprenticeship. Skip culinary school. Spend a fraction of the cost of tuition traveling the world instead. There is so much to learn from travel, especially as a young cook. You collect taste memories, understand the flavors of a place, and gain a sense of context. Eat cassoulet in Toulouse, hummus in Jerusalem, ramen in Kyoto, and ceviche in Lima. Make these classics your beacons so that when you return to your own kitchen and change a recipe, you know precisely how it diverges from the original. Travel offers another extraordinary value, too. Watch and learn from cooks around the world and discover the universality of good cooking. For the first 4 years of my cooking career, Chez Panisse was my only point of reference. Eventually, I couldn't contain my curiosity any longer. I had to go to Europe and cook in the kitchens that inspired the chefs who'd taught me. Arriving in Tuscany, I was surprised by how familiar it felt to cook alongside Benedetta and Dario. Some habits seemed to be common to all good cooks. Benedetta doted on her onions as they browned and brought roasts to room temperature before cooking them, just as the chefs at home had taught me to do. Heating up a pot of oil for deep frying, she tested its temperature not with a thermometer, but by dropping in a stale crust of bread to see how quickly it turned golden brown, just as I'd learned to do the first time I'd fried glimmering fresh anchovies at Chez Panisse. Curious, I began to watch others who cooked the foods I loved to eat. Enzo, my favorite pizzaiolo in Florence, served only three classic pizzas, marinara, margherita, and Napoli. He worked alone, snapped at regulars and tourists alike, and eschewed all luxuries, cooking all night in a kitchen the size of a postage stamp. I never saw Enzo use a thermometer to gauge the temperature of his wood-burning oven. Instead, he paid attention to his pizzas. If they burned before the toppings cooked, the oven was too hot. If they emerged pale, he'd throw another log onto the fire. And his method worked. With its crisp yet chewy crust and barely melted cheese, I'd never tasted a better pizza. I left Italy and traveled to visit friends and family around the world. Late one night at a bustling roadside stand, I ate flavorful chapli kebabs, Pakistan's mouth-watering answer to the hamburger. The cook flavored the meat with chilies, ginger, and cilantro, flattened each patty, and slid it into hot oil, monitoring the gurgling fat to decide if he should add more coal to the fire beneath the meter-wide iron pan. When the bubbles relented and the meat was as dark as the tea leaves in his cup, he pulled the kebab from the oil. He handed me one, wrapping it with a warm naan and drizzling it with yogurt sauce. I took a bite. Heaven. I thought back to one of my first nights in the kitchen at Chez Panisse, when I'd watched Amy, a soft-spoken chef, grill steaks for 100 guests, graceful and skillful as a dancer. She showed me how she watched the surface of each steak. If the meat didn't sizzle as it hit the grill, she'd stoke the fire, pulling more coals beneath the metal grates. If the meat browned too quickly, she'd spread out the coals and wait for the grill to cool before continuing. Amy showed me how to ensure that the heat was just right so that the steaks browned evenly on the surface as the interior cooked, so that by the time they reached medium rare, the outside was mouth-wateringly charred, and the strip of fat lining the edge of each ribeye was perfectly rendered. It was no different than turning up or down the flame on the stove. When I left Pakistan, I visited my grandparents' farm on the coast of the Caspian Sea in Iran, where my grandmother spent all day in the kitchen. Though she loved to cook for her family, she nevertheless grumbled about how ours is the most labor-intensive cuisine in the world. She chopped mountains of herbs, peeled and prepared cases of vegetables, and tended to horeshs, complex meat and vegetable stews, as they simmered on the stove for hours. My grandmother watched and stirred the bubbling pots constantly, never stilled, never boiling, until finally the stews were done. My uncles, on the other hand, would spend all day smoking filterless cigarettes and telling stories before they lit the fire shortly before dinner. They'd thread chicken and lamb onto flat metal skewers and cook the kebabs quickly over grills so hot their arm hairs regularly caught fire. One kind of cooking took all day, the other minutes. Both kinds were delicious. Our meals wouldn't have been complete without either the tender horesh or the juicy charred kebabs. As I traveled, I noticed that in every country, whether I was watching home cooks or professional chefs, and whether they were cooking over live fire or on a camp stove, the best cooks looked at the food, not the heat source. I saw how good cooks obeyed sensory cues rather than timers and thermometers. They listened to the changing sounds of a sizzling sausage, watched the way a simmer becomes a boil, felt how a slow-cooked pork shoulder tightens and then relaxes as hours pass, and tasted a noodle plucked from boiling water to determine whether it's al dente. In order to cook instinctually, I needed to learn to recognize these signals. I needed to learn how food responds to the fourth element of good cooking: heat. What is heat? Heat is the element of transformation. No matter its source, heat triggers the changes that take our food from raw to cooked, runny to set, flabby to firm, flat to risen, and pale to golden brown. Unlike salt, fat, and acid, heat is flavorless and intangible, but its effects are quantifiable. Heat's sensory cues, including sizzles, spatters, crackles, steam, bubbles, aromas, and browning, are often more important than a thermometer. All of your senses, including common sense, will help you gauge heat's effects on food. Exposure to heat changes food in many different but predictable ways. Once familiar with how different foods respond to heat, you'll make better choices about how to shop at the market, plan a menu, and cook every dish. Turn your attention away from the oven dial or the knob of the stove and toward the food you're cooking. Heed the clues. Is the food browning, firming, shrinking, crisping, burning, falling apart, swelling, or cooking unevenly? These cues matter considerably more than whether you're cooking on an electric rather than gas stove, on a makeshift camping grill rather than in a grand marble hearth, or whether your oven is set to 350 degrees Fahrenheit or 375 degrees Fahrenheit. Just as I learned from watching cooks all around the world, no matter what you're cooking or what heat source you're using, the aim is always the same. Apply heat at the right level and at the right rate so that the surface of a food and its interior are done cooking at the same time. Think about making a grilled cheese sandwich. The goal is to use the right level of heat so that the bread turns golden brown toasty delicious at the same rate that the cheese melts. Heat it too quickly and you'll burn the outside and be left with an undercooked center, burnt bread, unmelted cheese. Heat it too slowly and you'll dry the whole thing out before the surface has a chance to brown. View everything you cook like that grilled cheese sandwich. Is the skin of the roast chicken golden brown by the time the bird is cooked? Is the asparagus cooked all the way through by the time it's developed the perfect char from the grill? Is the lamb chop evenly brown, all of its fat rendered by the time the meat is perfectly medium rare? Just as with salt, fat, and acid, the first step to getting the results you want from heat is to know what you're after. Know what results you seek so that you can take the steps to achieve them. Think about your goals in the kitchen in terms of flavors and textures. Do you want your food to be browned, crisp, tender, soft, chewy, caramelized, flaky, moist? Next, work backward. Make a clear plan for yourself using sensory landmarks to guide you back to your goal. For example, if you want to end up with a bowl of flavorful snowy white mashed potatoes, then think about the last step, mashing potatoes with butter and sour cream and tasting and adjusting for salt. To get there, you'll need to simmer the potatoes in salted water until they're tender. To get there, you'll need to peel and cut the potatoes. There's your recipe. For something more complicated, say crispy pan-fried potatoes, you'll want to end with a golden brown crust and a tender interior, so the last step will be frying in hot fat to achieve crispness. To get there, make sure the potatoes are tender inside. Simmer them in salted water. To get there, peel and cut them. There's another recipe. This is good cooking, and it's simpler than you might think. How heat works. The science of heat. Simply put, heat is energy. Food is primarily made up of four basic types of molecules: water, fat, carbohydrates, and protein. As food is heated, the molecules within it begin to speed up, colliding with each other as they go. As molecules gain speed, they also gain the power to break free of the electrical forces uniting their atoms. Some atoms can split off and join up with other atoms to create new molecules. This process is called a chemical reaction. And the chemical reactions initiated by heat affect the flavor and texture of food. Water, fat, carbohydrate, and protein molecules each react to heat in different yet predictable ways. If this seems overwhelming, don't worry, it's not. The science of heat, luckily, adheres to common sense. Water and heat. Water is an essential element of practically all foods. Cook most of its water out, and food will become crisp or dry. Leave its water in, or add water as you cook, to make food moist and tender. Cook water out of scrambled eggs, and they will be dry. Cook the right amount of water into rice, cornmeal, potatoes, or any other starch, and they will be tender. Vegetables that lose water become limp. During years with intense rainy seasons, fruit will taste watery. Overwater your tomato plants, and the flavor of the tomatoes will be diluted. When food is weak in flavor, it's watered down. To intensify flavors in soups, stocks, and sauces, reduce their water content. Use heat to control food's water content to get the texture and flavor you seek. When frozen, water expands. This is why you must always leave headroom in jars of soup or stock you plan to freeze, or why a bottle of beer or wine you stick in the freezer to chill will explode if forgotten. On a much, much tinier scale, at the cellular level, a similar phenomenon occurs inside foods. As food freezes, its cell walls, much like your storage containers, will burst when the water they contain expands. Freezer burn and dehydration, then, are the result of water escaping from the inside of a food's cells and then crystallizing or vaporizing on the surface of the food. Have you ever opened a package of frozen berries or meat and wondered where those Antarctic stalactites came from? Now you know, from inside your food. This dehydration also sadly explains that leathery steak you forgot about in the freezer for 3 years, and is helpful to remember when deciding whether or not freezing will damage a particular food. In other words, choose to freeze foods that can withstand a little dehydration and even be successfully rehydrated. Raw braising cuts of meat, stews, soups, sauces, and cooked beans in their liquid. Water can also be a medium in which we cook other foods. At low temperatures, water is particularly gentle. Water baths are ideal for cooking custards, and simmering, braising, and poaching provide tough foods with the sustained low heat they need to develop tenderness. Heat water further to 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level, and it boils, giving us one of the most efficient and quickest ways to cook food. Boiling water is one of the most invaluable tools in the kitchen. It's a simple way to gauge temperature without a thermometer. If you see bubbles roiling in a pot of water, you know that it's reached 212 degrees Fahrenheit. At this temperature, water can kill pathogenic bacteria. To be on the safe side, when reheating soupy leftovers or your freezer stash of chicken stock, make sure to bring them to a boil to kill bacteria that may have grown in the meantime. The power of steam. As water is heated beyond 212 degrees Fahrenheit, it transforms into steam, another of the kitchen's most valuable visible cues. Let the sight of steam help you approximate temperature. As long as food is wet and giving off steam, its surface temperature probably isn't hot enough to allow browning to begin. Remember, the reactions that cause food to brown, caramelization and the Maillard reaction, don't begin until food reaches much higher temperatures. So if water is present on the surface of a food, it can't brown. Learn to make decisions in relationship to steam. Encourage steam to escape if you want temperatures to rise and food to brown. Contain and recycle steam with a lid to allow food to cook in a moist environment if you want to prevent or delay browning. Food piled up in a pan can affect steam levels by acting like a makeshift lid. Both entrap steam. Trapped steam condenses and drips back down, keeping food moist and maintaining the temperature right around 212 degrees Fahrenheit. At first, entrapped steam gently wilts food, and then it leads to sweating, which is a way to cook food through without allowing it to develop any color. Steam replaces some of the air contained in vegetables with water, which is why plants initially transform from opaque to translucent in color and reduce in volume as they cook. They also begin to intensify in flavor. A mountain of just washed spinach becomes a molehill of wilted greens, and a pan mounded full of sliced onions cooks down into a stewy, flavorful base for silky sweet corn soup. Pile charred leaves high above the sides of a pan and let steam cook the greens. Cover with a lid if you like, but stir once in a while with tongs to ensure even cooking, because even steam can't navigate the labyrinth of greens as evenly as you might hope. The temperature at the bottom of the pan, closer to the heat source, will always be higher than the temperature above. Control steam in the oven when roasting or toasting foods using the same variables. How tightly a sheet pan of vegetables is packed is as much of a factor in even browning as the oven temperature. Let zucchini and peppers develop glorious sweetness and flavor by spreading them out so steam can escape and browning can begin sooner. Protect denser vegetables that take longer to cook, such as artichokes or cipollini onions, from browning too much before they can cook through by packing them tightly in a pan to entrap steam. Choose your cooking vessel based on how steam will move within and out of it. Pans with sloped or curved sides are better at allowing steam to escape than pans with straight sides. And the taller the sides of the pan or pot, the longer it will take steam to escape. Deep pots and pans are great for sweating onions and simmering soups, but less ideal for foods you aim to sear and brown quickly, such as scallops and steaks. Recall the osmosis that salt initiates and weave that understanding into how you decide to use steam. Let salt do its work, drawing water out of food it touches, to help create steam when you want it in the pan. When the goal is to brown swiftly, wait to salt food until after it begins to crisp, or salt far enough in advance to let osmosis occur, pat food dry, and then place into a hot pan. Use the former method for onions you want to sweat and keep translucent for cauliflower soup, and the latter for eggplant and zucchini you plan to grill or roast. Fat and heat. In the fat chapter, I explain the main principles that will help you understand how heat and fat work together in good cooking. Like water, fat is both a basic component of food and a cooking medium. But fat and water are enemies. They don't mix, and they respond very differently to heat. Fats are flexible. Indeed, the broad range of temperatures fats can withstand allows us to achieve many different textures: crisp, flaky, tender, creamy, and light, that simply cannot be achieved without the proper relationship between fat and heat. When chilled, fats harden and transform from liquids into solids. Solid fats, such as butter and lard, are a boon to pastry chefs who can work them into doughs to achieve flakiness or whip air into them to achieve lightness. But picture the way greens cooked with bacon leave a trail of semi-solid grease behind on the platter, and you'll see how this quality is less desirable when serving food containing animal fats that congeal at room temperature. Extended, gentle heat will transform or render solid animal fats into pure liquid fats, such as pork lard or beef tallow. In slow-cooked meats, such as sage and honey-smoked chicken, rendering fats essentially bastes food from within. And this self-basting also explains the exuberantly moist texture of slow-roasted salmon. The same gentle heat will cause butter's emulsion to break and then clarify. At moderate temperatures, fat is an ideal gentle cooking medium, perfect for using in a cooking method called confit, which is essentially poaching in fat instead of water. While water boils and vaporizes at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, fats can climb to staggering temperatures well beyond that point before turning to smoke. As a result, since water and fat don't mix, foods containing water, which is practically all foods, won't dissolve in fat. Instead, the surfaces of foods exposed to very hot fats can climb to high enough temperatures to develop crisp textures as water evaporates. Fats are slow to cool and heat. In other words, it takes a lot of energy to heat or cool a unit of fat by even a few degrees. This is a boon to the amateur deep fryer. You can relax when frying beer-battered fish, knowing you don't have to act with lightning-quick reflexes when the temperature of the oil starts to rise or fall. If the fat gets too hot, just turn off the heat or carefully add a little more room temperature oil. If the pot gets too cold, increase the heat and wait before adding more food. The same phenomenon will cause meats with large quantities of fat, such as prime rib or pork loin roasts, or those sitting in fat, to continue cooking slowly, even when pulled from the heat. Carbohydrates and heat. Found primarily in foods made from plant sources, carbohydrates provide food with both structure and flavor. In the acid chapter, I described three types of carbohydrates: cellulose, sugars, and pectin. Along with a fourth type of carbohydrate, starches, cellulose provides much of the bulk and texture of plant-derived foods, while sugars offer flavor. When heated, carbohydrates generally absorb water and break down. Understanding a bit of basic plant anatomy will help you determine how to cook various plant-derived foods. Refer to the chart in the accompanying PDF. If fibrous or stringy is a word that comes to mind when you think of a particular fruit or vegetable, it's rich in cellulose, a type of carbohydrate that isn't broken down by heat. Cook cellulose-rich produce, such as collard greens, asparagus, or artichokes, until it absorbs enough water to become tender. Leaves have less cellulose fibers than stems or stalks, which is why kale and chard stems cook at a different rate than their leaves and ought to be stemmed and cooked separately, or simply staggered into the pot. Starches. Give the starchiest parts of plants, including tubers such as potatoes, and seeds such as dried beans, plenty of water and time over gentle heat to coax out their tenderness. Starches absorb liquid and swell or break down, so firm potatoes become delightfully creamy, impossibly hard chickpeas transform into buttery bites, and rice goes from indigestible to fluffy and tender. Dry seeds, grains, and legumes, including rice, beans, barley, chickpeas, and wheat berries, generally need water and heat to make them edible. To protect the potential for life that they contain, seeds have evolved with tough sheaths that make them nearly impossible for us to digest unless we transform them in some way. Sometimes, this simply means removing the shell, as we do with sunflower and pumpkin seeds. For seeds that need to be cooked in order to become edible, this usually means adding water and heating them until they grow tender. Some starch-rich seeds, including dried shell beans, chickpeas, and hardy grains like barley, benefit from an overnight soak, which gives them a head start at absorbing water. Consider it a sort of inactive cooking. Some grains are processed to remove some or all of this outer sheath, hence the difference between whole wheat and refined flour, or brown and white rice. Without that tough exterior, processed grains cook much more quickly and have a longer shelf life than their whole grain counterparts. Ground or milled grains can be combined with water to make doughs and batters, which firm and set up with exposure to heat. The key to cooking starches properly is using the correct amount of water and heat. Use too little water or undercook starches and they will be dry and unpleasantly tough in the center. Cakes and bread baked with too little water are dry and crumbly. Undercooked pasta, beans, and rice are unpleasantly tough in the center. But use too much water or heat, or simply overcook starches, and they will be mushy. Think limp noodles and soggy cakes and rice. Starches are eager to undergo browning and will burn easily if overcooked or exposed to too much heat. I kick myself when this happens. Scorched grits at the bottom of an unwatched pot, or breadcrumbs blackened after just 90 seconds of neglect in a hot oven. Sugars. Odorless and colorless, sucrose or sugar is the pure manifestation of sweetness. When exposed to heat, it melts. Mix granulated sugar with water and heat it to high temperatures to yield myriad confectionery delights with varied textures. Marshmallows, meringues, fudge, nougat, butterscotch, brittle, toffee, pralines, and caramel candies. Working with hot sugar is one of the few temperature-specific endeavors in the kitchen, but it's not a particularly difficult one. At about 290 degrees Fahrenheit, a melted sugar syrup will yield a firm nougat, but just a 10-degree increase will yield toffee. The first time I made caramel candies, I was too stingy to buy a $12 candy thermometer. I figured I could just eyeball the temperature. As a result, my caramels were so sticky that I ended up paying hundreds of dollars for dental work instead. Learn from my stubbornness and invest in a candy thermometer to help monitor temperatures when working with sugar, and use it for deep frying too. Trust me, you'll save money in the long run. At extremely high temperatures, 340 degrees Fahrenheit, sugar molecules begin to darken in color, in a process that isn't entirely understood, as they decompose and reorganize into hundreds of new compounds, generating abundant new flavors. This is caramelization, and it's one of the most essential ways heat affects flavor. In addition to producing acidic flavor compounds, caramelized sugars introduce a slew of new qualities and flavors, including bitter, fruity, caramel, nutty, sherry, and butterscotch. In addition to starches that can be broken down into sugars, fruits, vegetables, dairy, and some grains also contain natural simple sugars that can participate in the same reactions as table sugar when cooked. They grow sweeter with heat and can even caramelize. As heat penetrates a boiling carrot, for example, its starches begin to break down into simple sugars. The cell walls enclosing these sugars begin to disintegrate. This frees the sugars to reach our taste buds more readily, making the cooked carrot taste far sweeter than its raw counterpart. The small amounts of sugars that most vegetables contain begin to disappear the moment they're picked, which is why just picked produce is so much more sweet and flavorful than store-bought. I've heard countless stories of Midwestern grandmothers putting the pot of water on to boil before sending the kids out to the garden to pick corn. Just a few minutes, they'd tell the kids, could mean a noticeable loss in sweetness. As it turns out, the grannies were right. Just a few hours at room temperature can deprive starchy vegetables like corn and peas of half of their sugars. Potatoes, too, are at their sweetest when first harvested. Hence the indescribable pleasure of boiled new potatoes topped with butter. As potatoes sit in storage all year, though, their sugars convert to starches. Fry newly dug potatoes full of sugar and they'll burn before they can cook through. Instead, when making potato chips or fries, use starchy older potatoes and rinse them of excess starches after slicing until the water runs clear. Only then will your fried potatoes emerge from the hot oil of the fry pot, crisp but not burnt. Pectin. Another carbohydrate, pectin, is a kind of indigestible fiber, and I like to think of it as fruit and vegetable-derived gelatin. Found primarily in the seeds and peels of citrus fruits, stone fruits, and apples, pectin functions as a gelling agent when combined with sugar and acid and exposed to heat. Its setting properties make possible fruit preserves and fruit pastes, such as membrillo, the Spanish quince paste. From June Taylor, a champion of traditional British preserve-making methods, I learned to extract pectin from citrus into my marmalade. She taught me to place a couple handfuls of membranes and seeds into a cheesecloth and cook it into the marmalade along with the fruit. When the preserves are partially cooked, I remove the bag, let it cool, and then massage it to coax out the pectin. The first time I did this, I was shocked to find that I could actually see the pectin, a milky white liquid. When months later I opened that jar of marmalade, the pectin's effects were clear. The marmalade was set, not runny, and spread smoothly across my hot buttered toast.